So I stopped crying, and at that moment I was more than ever dedicated to help women, that such a terrible thing as that could go on in any part of the world. And I wanted to help, to do something to help women. I wanted a baby of my own still more than ever. But after that fame, that lovely nurse had delivered that 7 months old baby that had been dead a week, and I was filled with poison. It was by the grace of God that I didn't die. The one thing she asked me to do, she asked us to give her a pound. That was her fee for delivering babies. We gave her 2 pounds, I remember. She said, there's just one favor I want to ask, and that is, when you do have your baby, and you must have a baby, and I said, oh, not me, never, oh, I'm never going through anything like this again. She said, now that's silly. She said, you get your health back, and then you go ahead and have another baby. And then I want to come and see that baby. So I did. I had her address, and she came out to the Hampstead Garden suburb, and I had this beautiful little baby. And I have a new picture of her to show you if you want to use it in your story. I had taken when she was 4 years old, and she came to see me, and that was her reward for saving my life that night, was to come and see my baby when I really had her.
Well, so most...
Wasn't that amazing, that bitch?
Most of your time in England, though, basically revolved around your family life.
No, it didn't. I divided it. The German doctor that I went to, I had to go to Baden-Baden. This English, darling English woman sort of became my mother. And I had this terrible rheumatism. The English climate, of course, is beyond words. No words can describe the horrors of the English climate. And so I got filled with rheumatism and as the aftermath of this miscarriage. So my darling English woman, Lady Walker Smith, told me to go down to Baden-Baden and take those baths. They were sulfur baths, and get a doctor. And I got a great German doctor. And you will be amused at this. This German doctor gave me a whole plan for my span of life. And I said to him, why didn't somebody tell me all this in America? I never heard anything like this. And among other things, he said that I must never fail to have one day off in 7. Why, I said, I never heard of that. I thought once you got a baby, you never could leave it. Well, he said, that's ridiculous. Everybody has to have one day off in 7, especially a mother. And I said, but how do I do that? And he said, that's why you have a college education, to figure that out. And I did. From the time my children were born, I had my one day off in 7. But I did breastfeed my daughter 9 months and my son 6 months, because all the English women have been taught how to breastfeed their babies as a result of Queen Mary. Do you want me to tell you that, how that happened? Well, after World War I, England, of course, lost thousands of noble men in that war. And they always have been interested in healthy children and healthy men, and especially so they can fight these wars. And so Queen Mary heard that at that time, at the end of World War I, very few English women were breastfeeding their children, especially in the middle class and upper class. They had governesses and they had nurseries, and there was no breastfeeding. So Queen Mary heard about Dr. Truby King in the island next to Australia. What's the name of that?
New Zealand.
What?
New Zealand.
New Zealand. That he had invented a whole new system for the breastfeeding of children. And he said it was just as necessary, that teaching, as to teach people how to give birth to children. But up to that time, everybody handled breastfeeding just like you were a cow or a dog or anything. There was no training, no preparation, no knowledge. So he created an elaborate knowledge for the breastfeeding program, spiritual, scientific knowledge. So Queen Mary invited him to come to England. and put all the English women onto breastfeeding. And so he did, and they established breastfeeding centers. And the doctor that delivered my little girl had gone to that breastfeeding center and been trained, and he had, at the time I got there, he had delivered 400 babies, and there was only one woman went out of there that wasn't breastfeeding her baby. But he kept you there a month till you got thoroughly trained. And it's a very elaborate training if you're going to do it right and do it effectively. So I, being a philosopher and an investigator, thought this was very exciting. And I had very small breasts, and I didn't think I could ever do it. And small breasts are the best there are for that job. I didn't know that either. A lot of things I didn't know, and I learned something every day. So I went out of there breastfeeding my little girl, and very excited about it. And from then on, I began to study the whole child care system of England. That is simply tremendous. Every little village in England has a mother's clinic that's free. And all the mothers, even up to almost a higher class, go to those clinics and get trained for producing children and breastfeeding children and the whole business. And towards the end of my stay there, these mothers' clinics were also teaching birth control, so that the girls went there before they were married, thoroughly taught on how to handle the whole question of birth control. I thought that was great. And they advised the girls when they married, don't have their children, any children, for 2 years. It takes you 2 years to learn to live with a husband and him to live with you. And you want to get your married life thoroughly established, your companionship established with your husband and your home before you start having your baby. Think of that as compared to what our little girls in the teenage are going into, utterly untrained. And then when the baby was coming, they all came to the mother's clinics and learned to knit. And instead of getting long white baby clothes, why, they knitted all the garments for their little babies. And the wool that they bought cost 2 shillings. That was about 20 cents or 40 cents. And then they were taught to knit the little garments that the babies wore, everything, the jackets and everything, while they were waiting to get the babies. Wonderful. I started to knit. Knitted all that stuff for my little girl. And it was in a great hall, cold as ice, no heat. And all the mothers, all kinds of mothers were there. And they had a high platform at the end. And every mother, most of the working class mothers, had their babies with them. And they would carry the baby up to the platform and have the conference with the doctor, and we'd all hear the conference. Was that exciting? You heard what her problem was. You heard what the doctor said to do. Why not? Why should it have to be so intimate and private as they are in this country at a terrible cost of $1,000 or $2,000. There you were, free. And I needed that information. You know, it was a tremendous lot to learn, a whole new world of knowledge. I just loved it. And you would, I'll never forget one little woman, frail looking woman, and she had a big baby, a big John Bull. I never saw such a baby, with pink cheeks, a great fat baby. Beautiful baby. You never saw such beautiful babies as they had in England in all your life. The climate seems to help, although they get rickets awfully easily because there's so little sun. So they have to do things about that. But you go down to any of the shopping areas where all the babies and the mothers that have no governesses and the governesses are down there walking along with the babies. You never saw such, and I'm going to show you my little girl at 4 years old. You never saw such beautiful babies in all your life. They were just like, well, just like perfection. They were just like fairy children. They were so beautiful. And this was a great big fat boy, big John Bull. He was really. And those women, a woman like that, didn't have $15 a week to do everything. She was from the slum area, and very frail-looking little woman. And the doctor said, "Oh, Mrs. So-and-so, how well you are doing with that baby. I congratulate you that you're making such headway." Well, he didn't need to congratulate her. All he had to do was look at the baby. And she came down off that platform carrying that baby as if it was a precious, immortal creature. You never saw anything like it. The joy they got out of learning how, knowing how, not floundering, free. And these clinics were paid half by the local community and half by the national government. And so that this education they have made, after Queen Mary's interest, they had made of it a great science. So they have the lowest baby death rate the first year of life of any nation of the world except Denmark. And we're at that time 16th on the list. We're now 11th on the list of losing babies the first year of life.
Well, now, Jesse, when did you start becoming interested in public speaking and start going to the family?
Well, of course, I got switched there to other interests. But I had my one day off in seven, and there I beat it, and it was heaven to get that day off. He said, a woman like me must always have one day off in seven when you go into child raising, child bearing. And you get your toe in the door and you have something to think about that you, just like you girls with all your interests, would need an experience like that. You'd need a day off. And they taught me how to handle the breastfeeding with that day off. Do you want to know how that was? Because while you're a day off, you see, you went there that noon to breastfeed your baby. But in the morning, the British teach the babies from the beginning to sleep all night without any food in the night. Now, we in this modern country still get up at 2 o'clock in the night and feed the babies. But they say that if the baby learns to sleep all night the first month, for life they are sleepers. They have developed the habit of sleeping that stays with them for life. How do you like that idea? And they spend a month teaching them to sleep all night. The baby gets breastfed at 11, say, or 10, and then not till 5 in the morning, so the mother gets a good night of rest. And so the way they teach the baby to sleep all night is that when it's first born, of course, it doesn't know night from day, and at the appropriate time, 4 hours after it's been fed, it's awake wanting some more feeding. So instead of giving the baby a food drink, you give it a bottle with a little water in it, and this bores the baby. It isn't quite as good as a meal, so they won't wake up after a while for a bottle of water, and they begin sleeping all night. You just pat it gently on the back and say, "Now you must go straight to sleep," and give it a little drink of water. The nurse did that, of course, in the hospital, because you have to stay there a month. And so the baby sleeps all, my children never, no matter if they were sick as blazes, ever waked up in the night, slept right through. And that's just one of the skills that they teach you. So anyway, I began going around then to the different, I went to a village, I'd go and look into mother's clinic. And on certain afternoons, all the mothers came, and they would have some great authority from the central government out to talk on just some aspect. It's just like any science, there are endless aspects to this job. And they'd all come in, have a little cup of tea and one little cake, and then they'd sit, because everybody drinks tea, of course, and no matter who you are, you drink tea in the afternoon, and they would get weekly lectures, so that the whole vast subject of family life and child care becomes a science, and it should be a science. It's a tremendous subject. Well, anyway, then, my day off, I went down to the American Woman's Club, and Mrs. Curtis Brown of the Curtis Brown Publishing Company lived in London, and she had taken the most magnificent home that I ever saw in my life and got the American Woman's Club to buy it. And it was right on Grosvenor Square, just off of Oxford Street, the most exquisite, great mansion that you ever saw. And so we would go down there on our weekly lectures and have lunch there and have a lecture. And so I started a current events club because I discovered that there were a lot of those women that lived all over the world, but they couldn't speak. They'd never been taught to speak. And so I would assign to women to bring in the current events from the places where they'd been, in India. Or I remember the woman from Italy, and that's just when Mussolini was starting his fascinating career. And she was in love with Mussolini. All the women were. They thought he was magnificent. And he was saving Italy, giving them good railroads and good orderly government, and he was just a great man. So she would bring in all the reports from Italy because she lived there. And you never heard such current events as they were. And I was just the chairman. And I would help them to organize that stuff, and usually they'd write it all out and read it. But I'll never forget a brilliant woman that lived for, had been for years in Ireland, that quiet little place. And her reports on Ireland, the north and the south, were finally, because she was a very intelligent woman. And so we used to have 30 and 40 women there, and marvelous current events lessons, current events series. And then we'd all go into the dining room and have a beautiful dining room looking out on a courtyard in the back filled with flowers and shrubbery, and dining room just exquisite. And we'd all go into the dining room and have a luncheon. And that's when I sat with different American married women and got them to talking about their married life in England. And because they were all there, I said, who's taking care of your children? They all had big families, and they were all at my current events. See, well, I had my governess, but I didn't know they were as common as that. So they all, I would have lunch with different people, and they'd all discuss English. The English women belonged to this American Women's Club, because maybe they'd married an American, or the Americans had married an Englishman. So we got the different life. So one time I got them to put on a night debate on whether the Americans or the British made the best husbands. And we had nearly 1,000 people there that night for that debate, discussing the husbands. Which country got the best husbands? And all the ones married to the English husbands stood up for them, and all the American ones stood up for the American ones. And so it was one of the hottest occasions that we ever had. And then we had two other debates. One was on Puritanism and why America still had such puritanical ideas and why England had got over the puritanical ideas with George III. Got them out of Puritanism. We're full of it yet, you know that, don't you? We're just real. On this child care program, we're Puritans. A darling little child must be cared by only the mother and all that stuff. That's all Puritanism. So we had a debate on that, and we had a debate on birth control. And finally, some of the men, American men in London, came to my husband and they said, thank God for your wife. And he said, well, what's she done now? Well, they said, she's got my wife interested in England, and before that, my wife was going home. She was so unhappy. She hated it over here. It's a very difficult thing to adjust yourself to a country 2,000 years old from our 200-year-old country. And in that adjustment, you're followed with terrible depression. There is the feeling of the age and the solidity, and you can't get new things. Well, we just start anything, you can get it going. And I know the first year we were there, I've never known such depression. Of course, I was missing my job, but an English woman told me once, who was a metaphysician, she said, Mrs. Butler, it must be difficult for for Americans to get used to our country. And I said, oh, it's terrible, what's the matter? And she said, well, we're an old country and an old civilization. And you come out of a new civilization of people from all over the world. She said, we really only have two nations here, the Anglo-Saxons and the Normans. but you have all the nations, and you're used to that very. And she said, I wonder how you stand it. And I said, well, something's been terrible, and I guess that's it. So anyway, the American women came over with their husbands, and the houses were so hideous and cold and warm and unheated, and the buying of the groceries and everything was so difficult. And they just say to their husbands, well, you can stay here all you like, I'm going home. And so with this exciting program, we worked up at the American Women's Club, you know, and I used to tell them, now we must look around here and see if we have anything to learn. Anything to learn in this stupid, so old-fashioned, backward country? Well, I'll say we've nothing to learn. The sooner I get out of here, the better. And so in these roundtable discussions and in these debates at this current events club, I made those women look at the things we had to learn. And there are plenty. Take it from me.
Now, Jesse, you just mentioned that during your first year there, you were really very depressed about not having your job.
I never had been so depressed in my life. I just thought I'd die. I had gotten a very bad apartment for us. I didn't know how to find. They called them flats. It was the most hideous place. And they called them flats, and they were cold and uncomfortable and dreary. And then you'd go out on the street, and then about every other minute in the winter, we got there in the winter, were these frightful fogs that you couldn't see as far as you are when you got on the street. You couldn't see anything. And you breathed in this frightful, gassy air, you know. And I just cried all day and night for the first year. I've never been so unhappy. And then you know what happened? Well, Hugh and I, we were both sick most of the time because we didn't have the right clothes. And everybody, and I got a maid in the hotel, and she said we had to go out and buy virgin wool union suits. It went clear down to your ankles. And my husband said, you'll never get me into one of those union suits. I'll die before I'll wear one of those union suits. And he pretty nearly did. He had a high fever, and he was very sick when we first got there. So we had to get into these heavy wool undies, and with this fright, because the houses weren't even heated, you see. And then one day I said, you know, I hear there's a huge Christian Science church in London, and we were so homesick for America and our people, so we decided to go to the Wednesday night meeting. And my husband had been a Christian Scientist all his life anyway. And on Wednesday night, the Christian Scientists all get up and testify to their healings and how they're getting along and everything. And to this church, Lady Astor belonged. She was one of the leading Christian Scientists of London. And she produced 6, 5 children. And by the way, the Christmas that we got to London, Lady Astor went into the House of Commons. The first woman, American, to get into the House of Commons. That killed them. I think it was an American that got there first. And we got to know Lady Astor very well. And by the way, a new, huge biography has just been published. And the L.A. Times Sunday had the story. And we went to all A. Lady Astor's receptions. And that's another story, the adventure that was. Because of Hugh's position at the American Embassy, we got invited to all those big receptions that she gave for Americans and Britishers. So anyway, we went to this Christian Science church, and an Englishman testified. This beautiful, everybody, of course, is brilliant speakers. They're all, the whole nation is vocal. That's a story, how they got to be vocal. And anyway, this Englishman gave this beautiful testimony. And afterwards, I said to Hugh, I'm going back there and thank you. And my husband said, no, don't you do that now. You mustn't go around talking to people. We don't know this place very well. And my husband is conservative and on things like that with his job involved. So I said, well, you stay out here in the front of the church. I am going back to talk to that Englishman. And I found him back there and started to speak. And he said, oh, you're an American. The minute you open your mouth, you see, they know that instantly. And as my speech teacher there told me, I had one of the worst of all the American accents. So the minute I started to speak, they know it. And he smiled and he said, "Oh," he said, "you know," he said, "I'm so glad to meet you." He said, and I said, "Well, I just came to thank you for your testimony. We've been so homesick and so lonely," and it was such a beautiful statement. And so we talked there some more, and pretty soon my husband turned up to see what was going on. And, of course, he was delighted to meet my husband, who was in the American Embassy, because in Europe, anybody that's in the diplomatic service has tremendous standing, long way above what you deserve, really. And so this Englishman was in what they call the city. He was in the rubber business down in the city. And he said to my husband, "I would like to have you come to my club someday for luncheon." And he gave him his card, and he said, "I'll call you up about it. And it would be delightful if you would come." Of course, no ladies ever go to the men's, in those days, to the men's luncheon clubs. And we had another conversation, and as we left, my husband said, "Well, wasn't that nice?" Of course, I'll never hear from him again, but it was a very nice experience. Well, he did hear from him, and he went and had lunch with him. And the following week, he invited us both to his beautiful home in Grove Park, down south of London, for the afternoon for luncheon and tea. And he found that my husband was a tennis player, and he had a tennis court back of his house, so he told him to bring his racket, and they would have a party there and play tennis. And they just adored it that he knew how to play tennis, and he was a beautiful tennis player. So down we went to this, and that's just what we wanted, of course, was to get inside of English homes. And this was a beautiful home, just beautiful, filled with beautiful brass and beautiful, it was beautifully arranged, and our hostess had a greenhouse at the side. She had a green thumb. She had everything growing in there, and the tennis was at the back. And in England, the tennis courts are grass. They aren't hard. They're all made of cut grass and everything. And Hugh did himself well, played tennis just as well as anybody did. And we had a great day. Well, the next week, my husband came home and he said, "How would you like to move to an estate in the country for the summer?" I was out of the tears till when he got home. They'd been going all day. And I looked at him. I thought he was getting a little crazy. And I said, "Well, show me the estate where we're going to." And so down we went again to Grove Park. And it seemed the rubber market had collapsed that summer. And he was broke. And it would come back again. It was just one of those things. But at the moment, they would have to give up their house and their lovely cook and maid they'd had for 8 years. So if we would come and live with them as paid boarders for the summer, they could get through this fracas and be back on their feet by fall. And they showed us this great, beautiful room upstairs with an adjoining room for my husband, because the Englishman always has his own bedroom and dressing room where he can keep his things and where he can have privacy and so on. He likes that. So there was a room there for Hugh. And they charged us an unbelievably low price for our room and meals. And the next week we left this horrible, dreary place and went down into this beautiful home.
Well, how long had you been there at that point?
Just 2 or 3 months.
Oh, I see.
And they laid down rules and regulations. We had to be promptly for breakfast at 7:30. And we had to leave our shoes outside the door every night, because the maids had to always clean the shoes from the terrible rain that was going on. And we had to leave a pound every week for each maid, as you know, for the extra work. And we had never to enter the drawing room unless we were specially invited. And we had to dress for dinner at night in evening clothes and be ready on time. I said to my husband, "That's going to kill us. Never be late." And we had 4 months of the most beautiful experience. in which I was taught how to run an English home by this good homemaker, Mrs. Zorn, her name was, from the north, and all Europe, all England celebrates the women that come from the north because they're the perfect homemakers. And she taught me how to run a home and how to get servants and how to run servants. And every single week, everything in that place was cleaned and all the brass was polished and everything was done on time just like an office. I didn't know you could run a house like an office.
Well, Jesse, how did you feel after having had such an active career, though, suddenly leaving all of that now?
Well, that was great because I had so much more to learn. Then she had me get a bicycle, and so every day I went with her to the market, learned how to market. She taught me how to market, how to buy stuff. And then weekends, they took us on bicycle trips all through the south of England, paid all the bills, and we stayed at these beautiful inns down through England overnight, or we took bags of lunch and just went for the day, and we bicycled all over southern England, all up and down the curly little roads and the beautiful narrow roads and the shrubbery, you know, with all that rain, so beautiful. And then every night at dinner, we would talk about English customs, and one of us would say, "But why do the British do so and so?" And then our host would explain how it started, what was the history back of it, and how it developed. So we had 4 months of the most marvelous training and education about English life that no one that we'd ever known in America had ever got.
Now, when did you make this contact with the speech teacher and start your...
Well, then in the fall, we moved to this Hampstead Garden suburb. And I had this horrible miscarriage and all. And then after that, I kept on going to the running this current events class at the American Women's Club, and then I met an English woman who had been connected in some way with public service, and I said, "Why? How do you English people become so fluent?" "Well," she said, "there is down on the Chelsea Embankment Madame D'Estaire, an Irish woman who has for 30 years been teaching men and women, men and women, they were already becoming women, were getting into the House of Commons, but the wives of the men in the House of Commons had to go with them and speak with them on the same platform in all their political campaigns at the time when we were keeping our wives of men in public life under cover. The English wife went with them and spoke with them on the platform. And the Englishmen, when I asked them why they had their wives there, they said, "Well, my wife often wins many voters that I don't get. I always have my wife on the platform with me when I'm running for the House of Commons." So I thought that was very exciting, and she said that this Madame D'Estaire had taught 9 royal princes and many of the great orators in England who already knew how to speak but needed brush-up courses. So I beat it down to the Chelsea Embankment to Madame D'Estaire. And I got a shock. She had a huge room, and at one room there was a platform and a podium and a beautiful platform chair and chairs, and at the other room was where she lived, like a hermit. She had a little couch there, and she had a horrid little stove where she cooked. But the worst thing about her, this woman who taught all these great people, was she had a hare lip, she had short, straggly gray hair, and she wore a long black robe like the orators in Rome wore, the great speakers, only being Irish, it was black. And she had on sandals, and she was a red-hot Christian Scientist. Well, I never saw in all my life such a strange woman. And so I went to one of her classes then. So anybody could come on Thursdays. You could go in the morning. And she had discussions and debates and ruthless criticism. When English teachers teach people, they tell them the hard truths about themselves. and she would get these distinguished women, wives of distinguished men, highly cultured, titled women, that were learning to speak in a way that they could help their husbands, and just rip them up one side and down the other. I never heard anything like it. So, of course, that was my first experience with a speech teacher. So I asked her if she would come to the American Woman's Club and put on a class. Oh, yes, she would be delighted to do it. So I got back to Mrs. Curtis Brown and asked her if we could have a class there. And I said that she taught 9 royal princes and had many titled people in her classes, but I didn't describe her to them. And you know what snobs the American women are, you know. So when she appeared with this Roman robe on of black and sandals and this awful hair and everything, they just pretty near collapsed. And she started the class, and Mrs. Curtis Brown, the president, came slinking in at the back after the class started, and she said, "Who's that woman back there?" I'm sitting down. "That's the president," says I, like this, you know, scared. And she said, "Well, why isn't she here on time? She's late." Where Mrs. Curtis Brown vanished, never to appear again. Well, there were 25 of us there, but the next week there were only 15 left. Because suddenly we saw we had a great teacher. What was great about her was she didn't teach, as we do in America, the technical exactitude, but she worshipped the English language. And somehow she got into your soul that thrill of the English language and how beautiful it was and how it had to be properly handled. And we had, I think, 10 lessons. But for the first time in my life, I was the teacher's pet. Everything I said was perfect and flattering and all right. But some of the other women, she just slashed into bits, and they disappeared too. We finally wound up with 9 of us. And then at the last lesson, we had to make our final speech. And there was a student there who was a great advocate of B'nai B'rith, that religion, the B'nai B'rith. And she was from North Carolina. And she had this soft, sweet southern voice and accent. Whereupon the teacher said, "We find the accent of this student the most pleasing to the English custom. It's so beautiful, and the way she speaks is so lovely and delightful." But then turning on me with a soured look at the last lesson, she said, "Of course, Mrs. Butler has the worst accent of any of the Americans, the most appalling accent. But she says what she says, but she said that what she says is interesting. She always has something interesting to say." Your people are accustomed to that way of talking, so there's nothing to be done about it. And the class ended, and of course my balloon had collapsed. So I went up to her and said, "Well, what's the use of my going on with public speaking with that bad accent?" And she said, "It would take 2 solid years of night and day drill to get rid of it, and by that time you would not belong in America. So I advise you to carry on. You're quite a good speaker. You usually talk about interesting subjects, and I think you'll be all right." So that was my first teacher.
Now, did you get any more training than that then while you were in England?
Not in England as a speaker. Okay. But I spoke all over England, especially to the Women's Cooperative League. A quarter of England's industry is done by this enormous cooperative movement where there is no profit and where everything is sold at cost. And to get that great organization, that's never been written up in this country that I know of anywhere, in order to get it going and keep it going, they had to train the British housewife how to buy and how, which our wives are never taught, and the consumer knowledge that they poured into the English housewives, and they had an enormous organization called the Women's Cooperative Movement, and they invited me to go to up north to their annual meeting, and there were 3,000 working class English women, and they invited me to come talk about the American women. And I nearly died of fright. I was so scared. My husband had to walk me around the building 5 times. They just wanted to see what an American woman looked like. It didn't matter whether I said anything or not. It was just, I was exhibit A. I was curiosity number one. My accent and the way I dressed and the way I talked. And then so I just talked American history. I gave them some more history about the pioneer life and how America had in 200 years, that's 200 years, built up this great country from the Atlantic to the Pacific with houses and schools and roads and industries. And I went into great detail about all that. So I made the best of the situation.
Now, were you still just having your one day off in seven, yeah, or were you more...
Oh, yeah, well, I'm afraid I began to get a few more days off in seven by this time. I had a governess, I had a cook, and then I had to get mixed up with this psychotherapist to get me straightened out emotionally so I could be a decent wife and mother. And I want to tell you something. I'm a terrific dreamer. I've got 6 solid volumes of dreams that this teacher who's now here in California has analyzed. She's a skilled person on analyzing dreams. And 2 weeks ago, I dreamed that I had been a success as a wife and mother. I'd rather have that dream than $1 million. So I really did work at it, being a wife and mother. But I kept up my career, and there's no reason why any woman shouldn't do that. If you find your identity and you find out what you have to do, if you are trained and have the aptitudes, you can still have a family and home and make a success of it. And the British women taught me how to do that.
Well, while you were there, before you came back and went back to school again, did you have any inkling that you were really going to get into this on a larger scale?
No, I had no inkling at all. I was, when we came back to America, after 8 years, it took